facilities were initially broken in by Justice Prosser, who was sworn in new admittees, and we sit not only in new facilities, but with a new justice, Diane Sykes, and you are the second oral argument to be held in this courtroom on the first day of September oral arguments. 98-1223, Richard Sider and Jean Sider versus Connie O'Connell, Commissioner of Insurance. Mr. Barnett, Assistant Attorney General, will argue for the Commissioner of Insurance.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Paul Barnett, and I appear today on behalf of Commissioner Connie O'Connell of the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance. I will refer to my client throughout these arguments as either the Commissioner or OCI. We appear today to defend the validity of an administrative rule that was properly promulgated by OCI in support of its enforcement and administration of the valued policy statute of the legislature. The facts before the court are straightforward and stipulated, and therefore I will proceed directly to the heart of the case. OCI's rule is a valid exercise of its delegated rulemaking authority for several reasons. First, the valued policy law requires that real property be owned and occupied, quote, as a dwelling. The rule furthers this statutory requirement by making it clear that commercial property, for instance, is not owned and occupied, quote, as a dwelling, even if the owner lives there. In this case, for instance, the Siders owned and occupied this real property as a restaurant and only incidentally as their residence. The rule is also valid because the statute creates two absolute rules, one of inclusion and one of exclusion. The rule of inclusion provides that all owner-occupied dwellings fall within the protection of the statute. Equally true, the rule's exclusion provides that all real property owned and occupied as commercial, industrial, recreational, or any other such use is excluded from the coverage of the statute. To that extent, the statute is clear. However, the statute does not unambiguously and clearly answer the question of whether it applies in the instance of a hybrid use of real property such as we have today. The rule purports to answer that question. The rule is also valid because...
What does the rule answer? And what is the ambiguity or alleged ambiguity here? Is it dwelling? Does it answer what a dwelling is? Or does it answer what occupied means?
No, the rule answers the question where real property is put to multiple uses, one of which is as a dwelling, how is that property to be treated under the valued policy law? And the rule, in effect, provides that where there is a mixed use, that the real property is, in effect, no longer a dwelling.
I'm well aware of that, counsel. What I'm asking is, does the rule address itself to what is a dwelling, or does it address itself to what is meant by the word occupied?
The rule specifically addresses itself to the phrase as a dwelling.
Thanks.
And provides that where real property...
The problem that I have with that is that I don't have any problem defining dwelling.
You know, I find that totally unambiguous. But when I look at the word occupied, I'm thinking, what does that mean? And so all those arguments that you made in these briefs about ambiguities and all that, I guess I have no problem with it if we're addressing dwelling. But when we look at occupied, I'm thinking maybe that does need definition, and maybe that's what the rule did.
Well, certainly in the Drangsvite case at 195 with second 592, the Court of Appeals examined dictionary definitions of the terms occupy and dwelling and noted that as to occupy, quote, means, quote, to take up residence in, to reside in as an owner or tenant, close quote. Now, theoretically, one is left wondering, well, if that's the definition of the term occupy, which the Drangsvite court concluded was unambiguous, why did the legislature then insert the additional clause as a dwelling? Well, it seems to me that the reason the legislature inserted that clause is to reinforce its intent, which was to give the protection of the statute to real property that is used in effect exclusively or predominantly as a dwelling rather than real property that is used for any purpose imaginable, but, oh, by the way, incidentally, the owner lives there. So I think to that extent, it was within that context that I think the rule purports to further illuminate the meaning of the statute.
Mr. Barnett, you've made the same statement again that you made earlier as you started your argument about the fact that the siders here were occupying this building as a restaurant and only incidentally as a dwelling. Why is it incidental? It's my understanding that was their regular residence. They lived there all the time, did they not?
That is a stipulated fact. However, the clause as a dwelling in the statute certainly means something over and above the term occupy, since the term occupy already envisions to take up residence or to reside in.
My argument is with that is with the use of the term incidentally. I don't know how you drew that conclusion that they were occupying it incidentally as their dwelling.
Because the primary use to which the property was put was not as a dwelling in the common sense that term is understood.
Well, how do we measure the primary use of the premises?
The primary use of the premises was as a restaurant and bar.
How do you know that?
I think evidence of that is reflected, for instance, in the insurance policy, which is at in dispute in this case. It is undisputed that that policy of insurance insured a commercial premises. It described the insureds as doing business as the Steinthal restaurant or lodge, I'm sorry, and then further goes on to describe the premises that are insured as a restaurant.
Would it make any difference? And I realize the insurance policy at no place mentioned that this was a residence. Would it have made any difference in your definition of incidental if they had another dwelling or another place? This was their primary place. They had no other place. This was it. This is where they lived, as far as I understand the facts.
That is correct. I think the existence of so-called multiple dwellings would raise related issues of construction. Here, though, the question is, how does one treat what is essentially commercial property under the value policy law when that property is also serves as the residence? And therein lies the ambiguity in the statute, if indeed there is ambiguity, because the statute...
If I could just interrupt you a minute.
Certainly.
I think that the questioning originally started out as to... Where do you see in the statute the words incidentally, primarily, exclusively?
The statute does not explicitly contain those words.
It says whenever any policy insures real property, which is owned and occupied by the insured as a dwelling, and the property is wholly destroyed without criminal fault, the amount of the loss shall be taken conclusively to be the policy limits of the policy insuring the property. You've put in the words primarily and incidentally and exclusively and void dwelling units. Where do you get all that?
Insofar as to explain the support for OCI's interpretive and clarifying rule. To turn the question somewhat on its head, the cider's position in this case would be as if the words any part of which is or serves within the section such that it would then read, whenever any policy insures real property which is owned and occupied by the insured, any part of which is as a dwelling, etc. We believe that using the legal analysis of adding or subtracting words underscores the ambiguity of the statute, because it is not at all clear which version, the one premised on the predominant or exclusive use as a dwelling, or the one premised on any part of which is as a dwelling, the legislature intended.
Is this a latent or patent ambiguity?
That's hard to say, and the reason it's hard to say is this: that the answer to that question, I think, would necessarily presume why the legislature did what it did here. And there are a number of reasons that the statute may read as it does. One reason may be that the legislature simply did not contemplate the hybrid situation we have here. Another reason may be that the legislature did contemplate the hybrid situation. However, the legislature was unable to or did not desire to reach the public policy decision to govern hybrid uses, delegated rulemaking authority to OCI, and within OCI's agency expertise, left it to the agency in the first instance to make public policy on such hybrid uses. Another explanation might be simply that there was support for being more specific, adding the terminology one way or the other, but that support lacked majority within the legislature.
Let me just ask, continuing with the same vein, now the Court of Appeals on page 7, the appendix 107, says that they consult the legislative history to determine legislative intent only if they've already determined that it is ambiguous. In other words, here they clearly say, the Court of Appeals said, this is not ambiguous. A dwelling, and you chose to give us in your brief substantial legislative history, but I just thought rather the legislative history is kind of confusing. Do you feel that the memoranda or letter from Senator Potter and then the response from Insurance Commissioner Hefty adds or deletes or subtracts from your argument? Is that the finality as far as what you think the legislative history is?
It is not the exclusive legislative history, but I think it adds to the validity of the rule in this way. The statute was effective November 29 of 1979. The ambiguities within the statute were relatively quickly discovered by the agency, as reflected in the minutes from July and August of 1990 of certain committees. And then in 1991, the present rule was promulgated. This court's decision in Juneau County at 221 Wis. 2nd 630 recognizes that post-enactment events may serve as a source to assist in statutory construction. Moreover, recognition by the agency of ambiguities in application shortly after the statute is passed, I submit, is consistent with the general theory of delegating rulemaking authority, and that is that agencies who administer and enforce laws acquire a certain expertise, a certain base of knowledge that may not be standard knowledge within the legislature as a whole. And in these kinds of situations, it's entirely consistent with recognizing the expertise of the agency that shortly after passage of the statute realized the ambiguity, the need for further clarification in the statute, in which the minutes that Justice Wilcox referred to are pertinent to construing the statute.
Mr. Barnett, if there's a gap in the statute, an ambiguity in the statute, why isn't it the role of the legislature to take care of that rather than of the agency? Why should the agency be playing legislator?
Well, I think it's consistent. There are several responses. First, it's consistent with this court's general recognition that agency rules properly promulgated are a form of lawmaking and have the effect of law. Moreover, this court has recognized that agency rules are nothing more or less than public policy making. And furthermore, the legislature in the first instance made the decision to delegate rulemaking authority to the agency in light of these general principles of law. And therefore, I think it is fair to conclude that the legislature fully in mind intended that the agency fill whatever gaps may be perceived through its expertise by the promulgation of rules of general applicability. And then if the legislature, either following experience under those rules or otherwise, disagrees with the agency's policy choice, the legislature is always, always free to overrule, in effect, veto that policy choice by passing legislation to overturn it. And so while the legislature always has the authority to legislate, the agency's rulemaking authority is no less a force of law simply because it is within the executive branch and not the legislative branch. The legislature is already given that authority.
Mr. Barnett, how should this case be decided if there were no administrative rule?
If there were no administrative rule, this court would be confronted with essentially the same arguments, with the exception of the argument that the agency made a policy choice from among choices. And this court would then be confronted in the first instance with the question of what best furthers the legislative intent and purpose in the statute. And I think even on that independent evaluation, this court would conclude that the purpose of the statute is best served by not expanding the class of beneficiaries to a limitless, virtually limitless realm, but rather in keeping with the legislative intent of narrowing substantially the class of beneficiaries, that where real property is used commercially, and then also it serves as the residence of the owner-occupier, that consistent with statutory rules of statutory construction and the legislative intent, this court would reach the same conclusion as does the rule.
Well, there's no prohibition here against using a dwelling for commercial purposes, so long, according to the rule, as the use is incidental.
Correct.
Isn't that pretty ambiguous in itself? I mean, isn't even that the ambiguity of the term incidental reflected in the record?
The purpose of the rule is to address generally applicable circumstances. We readily agree that there will be gray areas on the fringe. However, the purpose of a rule in general is to give as much guidance to the normal, if you will, situation, the situation that it is going to arise frequently, without promulgating an unwieldy stack of rules to govern every conceivable situation. So I readily grant that there, at some level, there will be ambiguities in the application of the rule. However, those ambiguities, I submit, are on the margins and not in the central arena governed by the rule.
Counsel, very central to a lot of people's lives is daycare. Let's say you have a woman taking in 10 kids a week, $75 a week, has a fenced-in area with some play things, some cots in the family room, $75 a week for 10 kids, she's making $40,000 a year. How does that fall into your rule? Is that included? Is it limited? Is it excluded? Is it predominantly?
I think when you get into specific cases such as that, they tend to be fact-intensive. I think, however, the rule does provide some illustrations. For example,
I know it provides, one is, I know the three that it provides. I ask the question as an illustration of, isn't there something beautiful to be said about simplicity? Look. Right now, either use it as a dwelling, as the Court of Appeals would say, or you don't. I mean, and there are no gradations. Just like I gave you the hypothetical on child care. I mean, I can give you a laundry list of hypotheticals, especially this day and age when there are computers and home businesses, people generating hundreds of thousands of dollars, primarily out of home. So why not just have it simple? Why, what was that with Doric simplicity? That's what I'm looking for.
You unfortunately do not hear that expression this morning. But.
No, I was unable to attend.
So why not? That's the way the appeals court is saying, you know, kind of keep it simple. Then you know there's predictability in the law.
Well, the question, though, I mean, that tends to skew what is the real issue here. And the real issue is, what did the legislature intend? And we submit that the statute does not readily answer that question in the case of a hybrid use in, Justice Bradley, your hypothetical or Sider's hypothetical. The rule purports to attempt to answer that question in the main.
The response is, if they intended predominantly or primarily, they would have said it. I'm not saying this is accurate. I'm just saying this is the response. They didn't say it.
But on the other hand, as noted earlier, if they intended to capture any use as a dwelling, no matter how small in comparison to the general character of the real property, they would have inserted words along the lines that I had suggested earlier, any part of which is used as a dwelling. The statute does neither. Fortunately or unfortunately, the rule purports to answer that question. It is important to point out that OCI could have resolved this question in a number of ways. OCI could have adopted a rule that would have coincided with the hypothetical involved here. OCI could have adopted a rule that didn't even recognize incidental uses, at least in theory anyway. There were several policy choices confronting the agency. The agency elected from among those policy choices, and it seems that this court, given the agency's expertise, should defer to the agency's judgment, given that the legislature did examine the rule. There was active oversight of the rule in this case, as evidenced by the correspondence between the Assembly Committee on Finance and OCI, and the legislature has done nothing since its promulgation. Thank you.
Counsel, it seems to me that in answer to Justice Bradley, your rules would have to say it is not a residential property, because the rule says a policy insuring real property, any part of which is used for commercial, non-dwelling purposes, other than on an incidental basis, is not subject to 632.052. So in her example, if I understood it, you've got a business that's every single day using the whole house, or at least a good part of it, for a commercial purpose.
Indeed, and I think the rule tries...
So the rule would...
Probably would disqualify that use as under the value policy law.
Thank you,
counsel. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Andy King. I'm a lawyer from Chilton, Wisconsin. I'm with the firm of Lutz, Burnett, McDermott, Yann, and King, and we represent the Siders.
Counsel.
I think you may have to raise the podium if you can. There's a button on your left, top left.
Just to get the speaker a little bit closer.
Right. Thank you. And by the way, since we are new in the courtroom, we tried to do some acoustic testing earlier. But if you can't hear, if you'd raise your hand, that would help us in dealing with this problem. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, Counsel.
The issue here is whether INS 4.01 sub 2 sub e exceeds statutory authority. This rule attempts to deny an insured the benefit of the valued policy law if any part of the insured's dwelling is used for a commercial purpose. The court has already heard that. On its face, the valued policy law applies whenever any policy insures real property which is owned and occupied by the insured as a dwelling. The rule, on the other hand, provides that if any part of a dwelling is used for a commercial purpose, it ceases to be a dwelling and thus is denied the benefit of the value policy law. The Siders do not dispute the fact that an administrative agency has the right to make rules. That's clear from the statutes. What the Siders do object to is an administrative agency creating rules that are in excess of statutory authority, and that is not allowed under statutory or case law. If the rule exceeds or in any way conflicts with the value policy law, it must be found to be invalid.
Counsel, just a couple of things. The thing I was looking at is that the insurance contracts are based on risk. I was just thinking that it would seem just a no-brainer to say that if you're running a commercial operation versus a dwelling, that it would be a greater risk. Certainly for restaurants, you have different patrons come in, you have hot grease, you have et cetera, et cetera. And it would be, if you're going to have a contract based on risk, it would just be a natural extension to assume that a dwelling, other than the emotional or sentimental value, that maybe that was the reason for the passage of 632, but the risk itself would be greater as you have the public coming in and out and just the use of the facility.
Do you think that that would have anything to do with the background of why this was put in the first place, as far as I'm talking about the regulation, the administrative rule?
Well, I agree with you. Can't dispute the fact that it's a no-brainer that a commercial property is going to have more risk inherent to a dwelling. The slip and fall cases, for one example.
And you eliminate that risk? In other words, because someone lives there, is there less risk or more or the same?
Well, the risk, the insured is paying for that risk to be covered. They're paying a premium up to the policy limits. They're paying a premium up to the policy limits. And whether it's a commercial building or a residential property, that's the maximum exposure that the insurance company has. And they've been paid to take on that risk. That's what the premium represents. That insured is paying for coverage up to that amount. Now, we're not asking, of course, for the insurer to pay beyond that amount. That'd be unfair, of course. But the insured is paying for that risk. They're paying up to the policy limits.
They're paying for the risk of a restaurant because they knew it was a restaurant.
Right, that's what it is.
So they knew that. In this case, it's not a question that they didn't know a restaurant was going on. But the risk in this case is not from the restaurant. The risk in this case is because it's a dwelling, and then we have to pay the face value of the policy. So the risk here is not the commercial nature of the property. It's that you have to pay face value. Now, just the insurance company claiming that it would have charged more premium because it would have to pay face value?
Well, I if you're asking me, I'm
no,
not.
No, I'm not asking you.
I would have. I'll be glad to.
But in terms of the risk here is not that they didn't know it was a restaurant. But the risk is not that they didn't know there'd be grease. The risk here was that they didn't know they'd have to pay face value. I mean, it's just the opposite. There was not a homeowner's policy here, right?
Right, and given the nature of the use of the property, that's something the Siders couldn't have purchased here. They had were operating a business there.
Right,
but
so
the insurance company knows from the start, at least in their case, that this was a commercial endeavor.
And they insured it with a premium like that. Maybe there's even a higher premium for restaurant business, right?
I suspect that there is.
Okay. Let me just double back if I can. Under 227.10, the agency is specifically permitted by the Administrative Procedure Statute to promulgate a rule interpreting the statute. That's 227.10.1. You agree with that?
Absolutely.
And although this court is not authorized specifically by statute to interpret statutes, it's part of the judicial process, right?
Correct.
Is there any difference between an administrative agency interpreting a statute and this court in this sense? This court may not promulgate an interpretation of the statute which conflicts with state law. That's a basic tenet of statutory interpretation, right?
Correct.
So, not going deeply into the jurisprudential issues, it seemed to me that under 227.10, both the court and the agency have the same powers to interpret a statute and interpret it in a way that doesn't conflict with state law. Right?
I think the court's role here is more to make sure that the insurance or the administrative agency doesn't go beyond what it's supposed to.
I understand that. I'm getting to that. But my point is, it seems to me that for you to argue that this rule conflicts with state law, your argument has to be that the interpretation of the insurance commissioner is just wrong, totally off the wall, totally in conflict, and it had it been promulgated in a decision by this court, it would also be totally wrong.
I'm hoping that's the case, yes.
It can't, because your position, it seems to me, has to be that if this is a reasonable interpretation, and reasonable has many dimensions. This is a reasonable interpretation of that statute. You lose.
Yes. Now, the reason it's not reasonable is if you look at the statute and apply that to the CIDR situation, they get the policy limits, period. You interject the administrative rule into the equation, they don't. That's on its face a conflict. And that's where the court needs to step in.
Say that again.
The Valley policy law applies to a dwelling. And it's been stipulated by the parties here that this was their dwelling. If you look at just the statute alone, the CIDRs are entitled to their policy limits. This was their dwelling. It was completely destroyed. That's, I think, without the administrative rule in place, that's
so this
can't
statute
be denied. When you interject the administrative rule, which attempts to say that once you use a dwelling for a commercial purpose or any part of that dwelling, it's no longer a dwelling, you're no longer entitled to the benefit of the Valley policy law, that's the conflict right there. Under one, the CIDRs get the policy limits. Under the other, they don't. And that's the conflict.
The commissioner says you're reading in the words any part of the real estate is a dwelling. You're saying they're reading in exclusively, and they're saying you're reading in not exclusively.
That's true.
So why is one reading in better than the other reading in?
Because if just part of that building is used for business and the other part of the dwelling, it's still the person's dwelling. The person is going to have a dwelling somewhere, and this is it. If we take the OCI's argument to its extreme, you're going under their interpretation, any insurer that is using their property for a combined use doesn't have a dwelling. They don't have a dwelling, and that's not logical. That can't be what the legislature intended here.
I'm not sure that's true. Didn't they afford for, quote, incidental uses?
And that's, as noted earlier, that raises a whole other can of worms there as to what incidental use is.
Right.
And most importantly, where did the authority come to say that incidental use is okay, but anything incidental plus one is not okay?
Let me take a different approach, although somewhat similar to what some of the other justices have been asking you. Let's assume that this court likes the approach that the U.S. Supreme Court took in the Chevron case, and we think that that's a reasonable approach to take in an analogous type of situation. In this particular situation, as I look at it now, it seems to me that the legislature was silent or allowed a gap in regard to the hybrid or mixed use. If that's indeed true, then the question, as I understand it, becomes whether or not the rule that was adopted is contrary to or contradictory to the statute. Is it contradictory here? Is it contrary to the statute here?
I think it is. The
in what way?
Well, without the rule, we have a dwelling here that's been stipulated in the facts. And it's the CIDR's dwelling, and it's been completely destroyed.
Isn't the legislature silent when it adopts the statute on the hybrid use or the mixed use, dwelling in restaurant, dwelling in commercial property? Isn't there a gap in the statute?
I don't think so. I think that argument could be applied to any word in the value policy law. You could go on to say the value policy law contains the word owned. It must be owned by the insured. The legislature doesn't say whether you have to exclusively own it or whether it can be jointly owned. It doesn't say that. So can the OCI promulgate a rule that says the statute doesn't say what type of ownership is required, so we're going to say joint owners don't qualify for the Valley policy law? I mean, that would be the same gap right there.
I wonder if you tell me what you think the Chevron rule is and how it differs from the current case law in Wisconsin. Dealing with this issue of administrative rules.
As I read the Chevron case, it's the intent is to have the court or to have the agency fill in gaps that have been left in the statute.
Well, they have steps, don't they? First, you ask whether the Congress has spoken to the precise question at issue, right?
That's correct.
And if the intent is clear, apparently from the language, that's the end of the matter. If the court determines Congress's, and I'm reading right from Chevron, if the court determines that Congress has not directly addressed the precise question, the court does not simply impose its own construction, but as would be necessary in the absence of administrative interpretation. Rather, the statute is silent or ambiguous with respect to the issue. The question for the court is whether the agency's answer is based on a permissible construction of the statute. How does that differ from the way we interpret it, the way we deal with the issue now?
I think the way the court deals with the issue now is by reference to 227.40, which says that the court must declare a rule to be invalid if it exceeds statutory authority. So you look at the statute and see if the rule conforms to it.
Well, don't we first look to see whether it's ambiguous or not, the statute?
I think if the question is whether you're going to be looking at extrinsic evidence for further guidance as far as legislative intent goes.
Well, if we look to, you don't think the statute is ambiguous, is that right?
I do not.
Well, if we look to legislative history and extrinsic evidence, would that support you or not?
I think the extrinsic evidence that's been in the record is pretty much inconclusive. It's all minutes and documents that have been generated after the Valley Policy Law was enacted. So I point is, I don't see how minutes from the subcommittee that met a year or two after the Valley Policy Law was created shows what the legislature's intent was 2 years earlier. It's impossible. It might show what that subcommittee's intent was at the time, but it doesn't show what the legislature's intent was when the law was enacted in 79.
Would it make a difference in this case if the building in question were seasonally occupied as both a dwelling and as for a commercial purpose, like a, let's say, a resort up north?
I think it would, in the sense that the statute requires that, as I read it, the insured be occupying the property at the time of the loss. You've got a seasonal property up north, and you've got a dwelling here in Madison, and it burns down in the middle of winter when you're not using it. I don't think that's your dwelling. You're not occupying it.
If it burns down in the middle of the summer, and you're there?
You're occupying it, then that's your dwelling. I think that's probably a question of fact for a judge or jury to decide if a person has multiple, what could be construed as residences or dwellings, which one was he occupying at the time.
What's your understanding of the legislative intent that is set forth prior to the enactment of this legislation? What is the intent of the policy, the law, value policy law, and where is it demonstrated?
The value policy law prior to the current law right now, which was enacted in 79, applied to all real properties. In 79, they narrowed that down, and they said it has to be your dwelling, and it has to be owned and occupied by the insured. So they've narrowed it.
And what was their intent to narrow? What was the purpose in narrowing it?
I don't know.
What? Why they narrowed it?
Well, if you want the cynical approach, I suppose it's because there was a request from insurers that it's difficult to, when you're talking about multi-million-dollar commercial properties, that and sometimes probably unfair to have value policy law apply to those properties where typically they're going to maybe overinsure them to be on the safe side, and then you have a total loss, and the company's paying out way beyond what the fair market value is.
There were several statements in both briefs as to what the legislative intent is. One of the statements indicates legislative intent to prevent windfalls, to prevent overinsurance, illusory coverage. I mean, there were some of the comments. Another comment of legislative intent was that homeowners, this is their, essentially, this is their castle. They shouldn't have to have disagreements as to the value of their castle. That's pretty liberally construed, I think, but that's kind of what you were saying. Do you advance any of those now? Some of that was in your brief, I think.
The reasons behind the value policy law in the first place as you noted, to prevent overinsurance.
What I'm looking for, and I might not be articulating this clearly, is what is your understanding of the legislative intent, and how does your position support that? Now, I know your initial position is it's not ambiguous, but let me get to legislative intent.
Well, the legislative intent, I believe, is to apply to dwellings. And here we have a question of a mixed-use property. It's still a person's dwelling. I think they should get the benefit of all those policy considerations behind enacting the Valley Policy Law in the first place. First and foremost, they paid for that amount of coverage. They paid for a premium up to $150,000. Now there's been a loss. The cash value of the loss is less than $150,000, but they still paid for coverage up to $150,000. There's no refund in the premium for the extra coverage that the insured purchased. I think that's probably the principal reason behind the Valley Policy Law right there, is to prevent overinsurance in that case and to make sure that the insured gets what they paid for.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but isn't that the concept? That's why they didn't pay out the $150,000, because you're saying that they paid for $150,000 worth of insurance with no consideration for the actual value. So I understand the condition.
Well, they paid for a policy with $150,000 base amount. Now,
yes.
I will concede that the policy itself purports to limit the amount payable by the company to the actual cash value
of
the loss.
That's what I'm talking about, because that was in that policy.
It is.
They could do that.
They could do that,
yes,
if it weren't for the Value Policy Law, would be our position.
And that was the risk here. That is, that the premium payer risk was that he wasn't going to get paid $150,000 if the actual value wasn't that. And the company was going to accept premiums for $150,000, but would only have to pay out for less than that if that was the actual cash value, so you couldn't perform a fraud on the company. Is that right?
Right. And just getting back to another point for enacting this law in the first place. Discussing with the citers as much as I have, the actual, this is the person's dwelling, and the actual cash value of that building doesn't come close to compensating the insured for what they have to go through when their house burns down from a fire. The inconvenience, the damage to the personal, all those things aren't quantifiable in dollar amounts, and that's another reason why this law was passed, I'm sure, is because the insured has to go through all those things when it's their dwelling versus when it's a building used exclusively for a commercial purpose.
Mr. King, could I ask a question? It's certainly conceivable that the Commissioner of Insurance would promulgate a rule that was contrary to the intent of the statute. But when that rule is promulgated with the participation of the legislature, as we have under the law that's been in place for many years, and the rule has been in place for almost two decades, should that change the result? I mean, isn't there sort of an acquiescence by the legislature in the rule?
Well, the rule has never been presented to the legislature. I mean, when this rule was enacted in 81, the statute that was promulgated under is 227.018, and that procedure requires that a draft of the rule is given to each standing committee from each house. And then if either of those subcommittees object to the rule, it then goes to the Joint Committee for a review of administrative rules. If the Joint Committee objects, then it goes to the legislature and they debate it. Here it didn't even get past the standing committee. And
well, they didn't
pass. The standing committee did not. That's correct.
And that's even more than they would do with a court ruling where you know, we make a ruling and then there's the assumption, well, that the court had done something and the legislature failed to act, and therefore they must have known about it. This would seem to me to be even more so when it was one of their own committees. I forget the name of the committee that reviewed it, that there would be some acquiescence on a rule that sat around for 18 years. I mean, you're saying that that they did not have knowledge of it? They're not held to that standard?
I don't know if I can say that. I don't know if they did or not. All we know is it never got to the floor and was never debated by the legislature. We don't know what they would have thought of this rule back in 81. We know what the standing committees thought. They let it go through without an objection. That ended the process right there. We don't know what the legislature is afforded.
But the process kept on going from 81 to the middle 90s, and there was no attempt to change it as far as we know.
Right. Which is all the more reason why it's been along for 20 years, it's time to fix it now. And this might have been the first case that the opportunity to presented where that court can do that. I've checked all the annotated statutes annotated. There's been no case on this particular administrative rule subsection of it. So I think it's a first impression for the court.
Do you think this is the first restaurant with a dwelling above it that has burned in the last 20 years or whatever it is? 18 years, forgive me.
No, it's the first one that's gotten to at least the appellate level. And we've had a case of an over-insurance. You've got to have a lot of things happen before it reaches this level. You've got to have over-insurance to begin with, and then you've got to have an insurance company that's not going to pay the policy limits, even to get yourself into circuit court. So those two things have to happen first. And presumably insurance companies are out there hopefully being careful about how they value properties in the first place, so you don't have over-insurance in a lot of cases. If they properly underwrite it from the start, these cases shouldn't happen. It's only when they're over-insuring that you're creating this problem.
How do you determine whether a statute's ambiguous?
Well, if you look at the cases, if reasonable minds can differ as to its meaning, I guess that's the rule.
We had a trial court, a court of appeals, they've disagreed. Is that right?
That's correct.
Pardon me?
That's correct.
Is that enough to make it ambiguous? I know you're saying it's not ambiguous.
Yeah, well, it's right. I'm saying it's not. A dwelling is a dwelling. And whether you use it for another reason doesn't defeat the fact that it's still your dwelling.
The chief gave an example of maybe the trial court or the court of appeals being unreasonable, I suppose, is the logical extension. Seems to me, if I had... take this exact operation, but maybe exaggeration of emphasis. Make the dwelling, the home part, smaller, and make the restaurant much larger with the ballroom, blah, blah, blah. I take 20 people and line them up on the road, and I say, are they occupying this as a dwelling? Well, I bet you I'd get lots of different responses. I might be wrong, but that's just my sense. This leads me to conclude that maybe it's ambiguous.
Well, yeah,
could you, and I don't mean,
yeah,
could you respond to that? Why am I wrong in this?
Because it's still their dwelling. They're still living there. A person's going to have one dwelling, and they may use it 80% for commercial and 20% to live in, but it's still their dwelling.
Does that make a difference?
I don't think it does under the statute. It's going to apply to all dwellings.
You have four. Many different dwellings.
I think then you're going to get tripped up on a requirement that you own and occupy it. It can only occupy one at a time. If if you've got other properties. I think you can lump all of them in under the Valley policy law because you're not occupying all of them. And getting, you know, that's the degree of use that can, that's, you know, that's something the insurer knows about when they write the policy. You know, that's not something that's sprung on them at a later point in time. That they're going to be surprised by that. When they issue the policy and underwrite it, they should know what the risk is. Presumably the agent comes out and looks at the property and they decide whether it's a good risk or not.
Something that's bothering me a lot in this case, and that is, I think the facts are deceptive here. We're dealing with a restaurant that might have a slip and fall and, you know, grease burning and all that sort of stuff. But youthful minds have to appreciate that the world is changing and that a lot of business is conducted in the homes where people are making, especially with computers, lots of money, so that I would choke saying, oh, someone's making $200,000 doing some selling long distance phone over the internet and using their phone. And that's happening, maybe not $200,000, $100,000, $150,000, designing web pages, day trading, all substantial amounts of money that I would choke to say, oh, this is incidental. I mean, how can the court say that making $100,000 is incidental? So I have some problems. Maybe you're not the right one to ask about this, but I need, this really concerns me because I'm afraid the facts are deceptive to what the analysis and consequence of any holding, one way or the other, may be.
I'm still at a loss where the incidental comes from. That doesn't generate from the statute. I mean, that's something created by OCI. It's a word they chose to limit what properties are covered by the Valley Policy Law, and I don't know what incidental means. I mean, I don't know if my house qualifies as an incidental user. I probably make 500 business calls a year out of my house. I don't know if that puts me past the incidental use and takes me out of the Valley Policy Law coverage or not. I don't know if that's incidental use or not. It's still my dwelling. I live there with my wife and two kids. And I'm making business calls and seeing clients there several times a week, even though I have an office elsewhere. But I think perhaps the administrative rule takes me out of coverage under the Valley Policy Law. I don't know. And I don't know where the incidental use requirement, where the genesis of that is.
I have a bright line rule I'm going to propose, and that is the both the insurance company and the insured are going to be governed by the nature of the policy they buy. So, since this is a business policy, the business rules apply, not residents. So, all of the liability that comes from running a business, you get, that is, your client gets the benefit of it. But you, who have bought, I assume, a homeowner's for your residence, you get the benefit of buying a homeowner's policy. That is, if it burns down, you get the value that you paid your premiums for. But if you have clients in the house, then you're going to fall under an exception under that homeowner's about doing business, and liability for that wouldn't be covered. So why not? We just say that you're governed by the nature of the policy and
because
not fuss with the statute otherwise, because it's made a declaration.
Because the statute says it applies to any policy, not just homeowner's policy.
So you think if I promulgated a rule like that, I'd be violating 227, either as the court violating its obligations or the administrative agency?
I think you would, because you'd be taking dwellings out of coverage of the Valley policy. That's not what the statute allows.
Well,
time is
so
up.
Much for my bright line rule. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Barnett. He has 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I would like to briefly touch on the Chevron test. As the court, or one of the questioners recognized, the Chevron test is essentially a synthesis of existing Wisconsin law in respect to reviewing the validity of administrative rules. However, the import of Chevron is not as much that it is an aid to the courts, although it certainly serves that purpose because it provides an easy two-step analysis. But just as significantly, it is an aid to those who are not judges, those who are not lawyers, but rather the agency staff who are not trained in the law but yet must, by virtue of the legislative delegation of authority, enforce and administer sometimes difficult to understand statutes. And it is easy for such a non-lawyer to ask whether the statute governs the precise circumstance with which the non-lawyer is presented, and based on the answer to that question, of course, then that will largely determine whether the rule is valid, so long as it is permissible. Also, Chevron is consistent with two important concepts. One is that the legislature and administrative agencies are partners. They are partners in the promulgation of public policy. And the Chevron deference paid to agencies who are asked to administer and enforce difficult statutes is consistent with the recognition of that partnership. Moreover, it is also consistent with Section 227.11, subsection 2A. That subsection states that a rule is not valid if it exceeds the bounds of correct interpretation. I think it's fair to suggest that implicit in that statement is the notion that there may be, in a given instance, more than one correct interpretation of a statute. And the rule, while expressed in the negative, can easily be read to contemplate that where an agency is confronted with difficult decisions of interpretation and application and could go one of several ways, so long as the way it chooses to go is fairly subsumed within the statute, it is within the bounds of correct interpretation.
Does the Chevron test ignore the plain meaning rule? I noticed that the Chevron test says, if the intent of Congress is clear, that is the end of the matter. It really doesn't say whether the intent is clear from the face of the bill or the face of the law. So are they doing, do you think implicitly in Chevron, the U.S. Supreme Court did what you are asking us to do in abandoning the plain meaning rule?
Perhaps, but not necessarily. And I say that because the Chevron case itself, the court did examine not only the face of the statute, but also the legislative history, and concluded that from all of that examination that the legislative intent was not clear. So, in a sense, it examined all indicia of legislative intent to ask whether the legislature's intent...
Well, then it did do what...
I think implicitly it did. Frankly, the Supreme Court...
At least as I understand the plain meaning rule, it's that if we determine that the words of the statute are clear on its face, we don't ever look at legislative history, even if the legislative history should show beyond any reasonable doubt that Congress intended exactly the opposite.
That is true, although there are even a couple of exceptions in some decisions from this court to that effect, but that is the principle that this court has followed, and we suggest that this case gives the court a ripe opportunity to re-examine the merits in today's society of a canon of rule that came into being 100 years ago. It may well be, I would offer at the outset, that this court will determine that the plain meaning canon still serves vital interests today, and the court should retain it. However, I think it is helpful, particularly given some of the recent decisions up, and I see my time is up, so I must end there. Thank you. Given some of the recent opinions issued by individual justices of this court raising concerns or questioning the vitality of the plain meaning rule, it seems to me that this is an appropriate case for the court to examine the merits of that rule and give the bench and bar an affirmative answer whether that rule, that canon, should apply today or the broader statutory construction model proposed in OCI's briefs should instead prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Prosser.
In proposing that we adopt some sort of different test, the rebuttal to that was that how is the ordinary person, whether it's an attorney or a lay person, going to understand the law if they can't rely on the plain meaning of the statute? I mean, you have, I won't say dredged up, you have dug up some pretty arcane material here that's not going to be readily available to the average person.
That proposition has some appeal, but I submit that the appeal is somewhat superficial in this sense, that legislative intent does not vary depending on who it is reading the statute, whether it's a lay person, otherwise untrained in the law, a well-educated and respected and experienced attorney, or a well-experienced judge. The legislative intent is a constant, if you will, and is not a variable. And so the one answer is that it doesn't depend on who's doing the reading. Secondly, even under the current regime, there's certainly no guarantee that what a layperson might conclude is the plain meaning of the statute will in fact be the plain meaning of the statute, and that's because of the way that the plain meaning canon has developed, the exceptions that have been created to in effect preserve it while still reaching a desirable result in a particular case. And every case of statutory construction, because of the plain meaning canon, necessarily requires the parties to litigate not only what do the terms of the statute mean within the four corners of the statute, but also in the alternative, what did the legislature intend as evidenced by extrinsic aids to the statute. And so even under the current regime, layperson's reading of the statute offers no guarantee that that reading will be correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45 a.m.